I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about, wow, is this in the news? It is in the news, but it's been in the news for as long as we've had our republic. And it's the issue of tariffs. What are they? What role do they play? What service do they perform? What are the advantages and disadvantages politically and economically of tariffs? I'm joined for the conversation today by Professor Rob Wiley. Many of our listeners know Rob. He's a professor of political economy at Ashland University. He directs Ashbrook's program on political economy, and he has studied the issue of international trade, of modern economics, and connected that much more deeply and grounded much more deeply to important political principles, political texts, and political philosophy. He's the person who's going to help us sort out the issues of Trump, trade, and tariffs. Today's American Idea. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Tariffs. They're in the news again. I think it's something people think, wait, what? Tariffs? Must be something totally new. Turns out it's not new in American political economy.
No.
First of all, can we start with this simple thing for some of our listeners? What's a tariff?
Yeah, a tariff is a tax on imports.
And a tax on imports, meaning anything that's imported in the country covered by that tariff gets taxed.
That's right.
Who pays the tax?
Well, the way economists usually think about this is with when you tax an import, the increase in price gets paid by the consumer. So we think that goods, tariffed goods, become more expensive to buy when you buy them. And it's not only necessarily goods that are finished products, right? But with these new tariffs, it's goods that are parts, even parts that are component parts of items being manufactured in the United States will be subject to a tariff, or raw materials. And all of that increases the price. Of course, the government collects some of that as revenue. Tariffs were an extremely important, the most important part of federal revenue until income tax, until 1916. They haven't been as important since. But another problem with them is as they increase the price, we think that consumers don't buy a good at all, right? So I might choose to take the bus rather than buy a car once sort of foreign cars are become more expensive. And this is what economists call a deadweight loss. And it's one reason why we think that everyone loses from tariffs when goods are made more expensive in that way. Consumers, of course, lose, but everyone loses because the demand, you know, once goods are higher in price, fewer people overall are buying that good.
Okay. Obviously, this is not the first time that tariffs have been an issue of controversy in American history. I think of it at least five important periods in thinking about the history of the United States and tariffs in the U.S., starting with the American founding. And it turns out there were big arguments between people like Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton on tariffs. Take us back to the founding. What were the arguments? Who was making them for and against tariffs?
Yeah, great. When I teach this period, I begin in the 1830s. Because it's during the 1830s that figures like Henry Clay and Albert Gallatin are arguing about the then 1828 Tariff of Abominations, the greatest tariff until the Smoot-Hawley Tariff, which many people know from the Great Depression. But when Clay and Gallatin are arguing about the tariff in 1828, they're using the arguments of the founders. But quickly, and both of them call their system the American system. But there are two American systems because, as you just pointed out, There are disagreements among the founders, and these are being dredged up in 1828. It's also an interesting time because under President Jackson in the 1830s, for the first time, the United States had paid off its debt. So in the early Republic, the federal government needed to raise revenue to pay back the Spanish and the Dutch and the French, and of course, the domestic creditors that had paid for the revolution. And so the 1830s is an interesting period because it's the first period where they sit down and they say, we no longer owe these debts. So should we still have a tariff for revenue, period? We don't owe a debt anymore, right? And that kind of clears the air. Everyone had agreed at the time of the founding that somehow the country's born in debt, you know, not just conceived in liberty, but born in debt. And they had to find a way to do that.
Uh-huh.
I could talk a little bit more about that. You know, Henry Clay says.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about that moment, because tariff of abominations is a pretty strong term.
Right. So one thing you have to remember at this period is that the United States early on really isn't one economy. The founding fathers, of course, get credit for devising a constitution and a system of government. But unless you study the economic history of the United States, you never give them credit for creating a single economy, a single national economy. At that time, they had basically no idea what that economy would look like. I love reading Hamilton's report on manufacturers, where he says the future of American agriculture is not cotton, it's hemp.
Oh,
anyone thought it was King Hemp and not King Cotton, you know, they might have gone to school in the 60s and not really paid attention to what happened after the invention of the cotton gin, Eli Whitney, and so on. And so the founders are trying to envision what that American economy will look like. The South at that time was the free trade element, because they had export goods and first tobacco, later cotton, and they didn't want other countries to reciprocate with tariffs against that export good. So often export-oriented industries, like the Southern planters in the early Republic, they were much more integrated with the global economy. And so they were much more in favor of free trade. While the Northerners were creating industries and they were competing with British goods. So we'd call those import competitive industries. And it was those industries that Hamilton wanted to defend in the early Republic with tariffs. So those sectional interests were often in favor of tariffs. But these two sections of the country had very different economic interests. They knew about them. Obviously, the grand moral drama over slavery in our country's history now overshadows that, and rightly so in education. But this is why students in high schools need to understand some economics to understand how these tariff issues really drove sectionalism. And part of the effort to unify this country was to unify this country with a single economy. And there are many different ideas about how to do that. And of course, there were disagreements about the role of tariffs in doing that. It was not Hamilton's preferred method. Hamilton preferred what he called pecuniary bounties, or what today we'd call subsidies, where the government would simply subsidize certain industries rather than protect them with tariffs. And then Jefferson does a bit of a volte-face, where by the time of his presidency, he's in favor of tariffs. That whole issue at the time, I think, is complicated, one, as I mentioned, by the debt from the revolution, and two, because there was no practical way for the federal government to really raise revenue without other countries had tax collectors. They'd show up at your farm and count your chickens and so on. But the idea of having an internal revenue service to go and see what Americans were producing all around the country, that would have been so expensive for Americans. I mean, also obviously unconstitutional for Americans to raise taxes in that way. And so at the beginning, I think it's complicated by the fact that we need the tariffs to pay the debt, and two, that it's really only the only feasible way for the federal government to raise revenue. In other words, they're not necessarily having the debate that they had beginning in the 1830s and then now, is this the best way to go given other options?
And then, of course, post-Civil War, you think the Tariff of Abominations was part of the buildup in the regional divide that you're talking about, part of the buildup toward the Civil War. Post-Civil War, it seems like there's a lot of time, political argument in the United States between Democrats and Republicans. The parties seem largely to hinge on tariffs. What's the argument that's happening in the late 19th and early 20th centuries on tariffs?
Yes, indeed. And so one figure that that President Trump likes to mention a lot these days when he's speaking about tariffs is a fellow Ohioan, William McKinley. McKinley's one of the first. So
I think President Trump called him the Tariff King.
We have King Cotton. Okay, no King Hemp, but the Tariff King. And so you're president at the turn of the 20th century, and McKinley's one of the first presidents that makes the argument that tariffs are good. Tariffs are a way to protect American labor. And the labor question becomes a question of tariffs. This is a good thing for American workers. They'll be protected from foreign competition. They'll be protected from being undercut by cheap foreign labor. And so certainly the tariff issue is a major issue in the late 19th century. I tell my students that in the late 19th century, political economy is largely about the dollar question, monetary policy, free silver, and also about trade and tariffs. And it's quite simple political economy. But one thing that's happening today is even as we look back at that, perhaps it was a golden age of arguing for tariffs in the president's mind, but at that time, it was always in conjunction with monetary policy. And today, I think a lot of the critics, there are a lot of practical critics that might be in favor of tariffs in principle, but disagree with the president about how to go about his tariff policies. And one sort of critic says it's really not being, contemporary trade policy with tariffs is not being pursued conjointly with monetary policy. So think about it this way. If the dollar is really strong and we can buy a lot from other countries very cheaply, we will. We will run a trade deficit just because of the strength of the dollar. And you can't really embark on such an ambitious and comprehensive trade policy without thinking about monetary policy. But back in the 19th century, it was both of those things always. It was gold against silver, and then it was also tariffs against tariffs. So the other part of McKinley's legacy that the president doesn't talk about is that McKinley was staunch on gold and staunch on a strong dollar.
So McKinley wanted the U.S. to be its monetary policy based on gold, and he wanted tariffs. His Democratic opponents were against tariffs or wanted lower tariffs, and they wanted silver as the currency of the United States.
Yeah, particularly the progressives, right? Like mm-hmm. William Jennings Bryan. So there were that was the descendant faction that, you know, he ran against Bryan, right? You shall not crucify humanity on the cross of gold, that famous speech in the Palmer House in Chicago. And so monetary policy was an issue. Today, President Trump seems like he's fine with a stronger dollar, although the dollar has been weakening lately. And we don't really politicize monetary policy since the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. But unless you think about monetary policy and trade policy together, it's very difficult for me to think how you're going to really ambitiously address these issues of trade deficits. Not always clear what the overall goal right now is. Is it to address these trade deficits? Is it to bring investment back to the United States? Is it to protect American jobs? There's a lot that's unclear about that. There's probably a lot that should be unclear about that, because no country has ever undergone deindustrialization and lost so many manufacturing jobs and tried to bring them back. So to some degree, we are in uncharted water on some of these questions. And, you know, our politics gets heated, and these are huge questions that are costing a lot of people a lot of money right now. But it's also worthwhile to just reflect and say, this is what the president is maybe trying to do is something that no country has ever done before.
Well, it does seem like, though, that McKinley, the tariff argument won, at least for a while, and we had relatively high tariffs. Is that fair to say? And then we get into the Great Depression, and you already mentioned Smoot-Hawley. What is that important moment in American economic history with respect to tariffs?
Yeah, so I would say that the Smoot-Hawley tariff comes in 1930, once the Great Depression has begun. And many economists think that it exacerbates the Great Depression. In some way, however, I would insist that it's a category mistake to think about McKinley's tariffs and the Smoot-Hawley tariff in the same conversation. Because, of course, by 1930, we have income tax. And so the federal government has a way of raising revenue And it's become the most important way of raising revenue directly for the federal government that are about tariffs. So it's not as if before income tax, largely if you want internal improvements, if you want a large and active federal government, if you want to increase the size of the United States military, you have to be in favor of tariffs. It's like being Henry Clay. You're in favor of all of these Western roads and expansions all the way up through sort of McKinley and the United States Navy and so on. All that expansion sort of hinging on tariffs. Smoot-Hawley's different, right? You have other ways of raising money, but you think that tariffs are going to protect American workers. And so that's an option that you are exercising, even though you could raise revenue in a different way. That tariff, I mean, initially there seemed to be some successes with Smoot-Hawley. People forget that in the first couple of months and years, it's quite popular, and there are sort of signs of American manufacturing making a rebound. By 1931, we plunged deeper in the Depression, and that's clearly just not the case. But by making everything expensive, right, by making all sorts of goods more expensive, you make people poorer, and I think the Smoot-Hawley tariff certainly did that.
What about then post-World War II? It seems like then we enter an era, and some people connected to Bretton Woods and the agreement there, of free trade and a kind of America turning away from tariffs. Is that true? Is that what happened? And if so, how did that happen?
Great. So I like that you mentioned the Bretton Woods Conference at the Mount Washington Hotel, because that suggests that at that moment for the post-war world, Harry Dexter White and the other Americans there were making decisions, thinking about trade and monetary policy together. There, they were really coming up with an international monetary system, probably thinking less about trade. But of course, there's the global agreements on tariffs and trade, or GATT at the time, right? That free trade is better for everyone. It's better for consumers everywhere. And so we're going to encourage that. And then later that becomes the World Trade Organization and so forth. Here was a problem with Bretton Woods. And this, again, is why I think that monetary policy and trade policy always have to be thought about together, which is one thing we're not doing right now. Bretton Woods, the 44 signatories to the Bretton Woods Agreement, all agreed that they would only draw on gold through the U.S. dollar. So there'd be exclusive convertibility. They didn't want to abandon the gold standard, but they also wanted to allow for some kind of expansionary monetary policy. They wanted to allow the United States government to borrow dollars from itself to increase the global monetary. But here's a dilemma that caused, and sometimes this, the Belgian economist Robert Triffin is the sort of name of this dilemma. If the United States is providing a currency for the world, so if the United States dollar becomes the international reserve currency, which it does by policy at Bretton Woods, that means we have to provide the rest of the world dollars to trade with. And often it's true that more dollars circulate outside of the United States than within the United States. The United States dollar is interesting. It's not just a national currency. It's this international currency for international trade. If we do that, then we need to be buying more from the rest of the world with our dollars than we're selling. It requires us in some way to run a trade deficit. It makes the dollar stronger initially by policy, because it was the only way you were going to get drawing rights on gold. So everyone wanted our dollars. It makes the dollar strong, and it means we're buying things from the rest of the world. Well, one thing as a result, that makes American goods made in America, according to workers, you have to pay dollars, makes those more expensive, makes other goods from other parts of the world cheaper when you allow us to trade with them. And sure enough, America begins running these sort of trade deficits. These two things are always connected, I think. You could argue that this makes us very powerful. Certainly the Korean War and the Vietnam War and the Great Society was built on money we could borrow ourselves, but from ourselves, and the rest of the world had to cough up, $35 to get an ounce of gold for it. But we could essentially borrow those $35 from ourselves and other countries would need them. And so a lot of American post-war power comes out of, I think, that Bretton Woods Agreement, at least until the 70s.
So then as we get into the 70s and 80s, you start seeing the expansion of the idea of free trade into significant free trade agreements, whether those are trans-Pacific, transatlantic, or whether they're North American. At that time, as these free trade agreements are proliferating, are we seeing a concomitant decline and reduction or elimination of tariffs?
Okay, so what one thing I would say here is that yes, you see a reduction in tariffs. Although I'd want to push back a little bit on remembering these as the halcyon days of free trade. And I even want to push back against thinking of agreements like NAFTA as free trade agreements. One
despite the name.
Right, yeah, of course, despite the name, the sometimes quite controversial name.
Tell us about that. Why do you say that?
Sure. So when you think about free trade, a real free trade system is every country trades on an equal playing field. There's no most favored nation status, or the country that pays the least in tariffs, because no one pays tariffs. And the original thought behind the global agreements on tariffs and trade, and eventually the World Trade Organization, is to reduce those barriers everywhere for more global prosperity. So more goods and services circulate. We think about wealth as purchasing power. So I'm wealthier whenever there's something I can buy that's cheaper, even if I don't exercise that option. And whenever a new product appears in the market for me to buy, I become wealthier. So you have to sort of think about wealth that way as your power to command a flow of goods. And then you want that flow of goods to be as ample as possible, as many exchanges as possible. So that's the original agreement. But agreements like NAFTA, so the economist Jagdish Bhagwati calls these termites in the trading system, because we actually will require the Canadians and the Mexicans to put duties on certain things that come from outside of the US, Canada, and Mexico. And so you create an island of free trade, so to speak, but you might actually be increasing barriers altogether. Another problem that the World Trade Organization is faced with, and it's in the most recent rounds of World Trade Organization meetings, there are these extraordinary moments where the World Trade Organization, dedicated to free trade and removing tariff barriers for all these years, has asked countries to increase tariffs. Now, this is sort of bewildering. And why?
Yeah, why?
Because there have been these non-tariff barriers to trade that are recognized as the bigger problem. And so when you have health and safety inspections that seem arbitrary, that producers in other countries can't plan on, these are really effective barriers to trade. Anything that's vague and arbitrary, and you have those kind of regulations that come in. And so at some point, the World Trade Organization and these Doha rounds, that these non-tariff barriers to trade are such a problem, we'd rather countries just price those into tariffs and then take care of that. Instead of saying, well, and also countries that are now claiming that, well, your goods are, you come from a country that sort of has all these carbon emissions and we're offsetting that. And so you have all of these complicated regulatory schemes that are increasing prices that, actually tariffs are just easier for producers and countries to plan according to and to price in. So there was a move towards free trade. We moved away from tariffs these sort of years of post-war prosperity. China being admitted to the WTO in 1995 is a huge moment. And obviously there were huge hopes that if we just liberalized trade with China and they had those economic freedoms, they'd develop a political system more like ours. Fortunately, those hopes seem to have been dashed, and we have to think about China in a new way now. And maybe think about our principles of economic and political freedom in a new way. I tell my students this is the living end of people like Locke and Montesquieu that we have to think about now. And this is the sort of new data coming in. But one of my hesitations is just to say, actually, I think we find in that period more sophisticated barriers to trade. They're just subtler and more complex.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
And that's an interesting nuance because it helps me think through, you know, I've heard people say there are basically three reasons for tariffs that have been advanced in the United States over the course of our history: revenue, restriction, and reciprocity. And sometimes President Trump has sort of made arguments on all three of those. We'll raise a bunch of revenue from this. We'll restrict in order to protect American manufacturing jobs in places like Ohio or bring back manufacturing, or reciprocity. Well, the French are putting big tariffs on our stuff, so we'll put tariffs on them until we can agree that to drop the tariffs. Is that where you see us now in the tariff situation?
As I alluded earlier, it's very difficult to pick through the president's comments and figure out exactly what the intention is, right? So one intention might be to, here's a fourth R, to kind of recuperate a kind of reinvestment, not to protect American manufacturing jobs we already have by restricting cheap imports, but by encouraging countries to reinvest in the United States by making it more expensive to produce goods abroad.
So rather than, for example, so a car company, a European car company, rather than produce cars in Germany, then ship them here and get a big tariff on them, they build their plant in the United States, produce them here, so the cars don't have the tariff.
Right. And this requires thinking about, you know, cars made in the United States, whether they're Hyundais or whatever they are, as American cars made by American labor of often foreign capital, but not entirely foreign capital, sort of invested in our country. At other times, though, the president talks about these tariffs as revenue. He'll talk about an external revenue service as well as an internal revenue service. That seems to me to be more of an outdated. I don't think tariffs are the best means of revenue. That doesn't mean that I disagree. That doesn't mean that when I go back to the founding debate between Hamilton and Jefferson, that I think Jefferson is right to say, well, we should only have tariffs based on reciprocity, whereas Hamilton's much more open to have tariffs based on revenue. Now, just because I don't think the tariffs are a great way to raise revenue today doesn't mean that I think Hamilton was wrong back then. We just have enough. We have an income tax amendment, right? We have an internal revenue service. We have other ways to raise revenue they didn't. So it's always been part of our history, an important part of our history to study. But it's not always the case that the solution at a given point in our history is the best solution now. And that requires having a more historical understanding of the options available at that time.
I mean, it is certainly true when I think about it, that there's the political economy, there's the politics, and then there's the economics of it. The politics side of it is interesting to me. And one significant difference, it seems to be, between the current situation with tariffs and previously, which is now it's the president unilaterally imposing tariffs. In the past, these great tariffs debate in American history, tariff of abominations in the 19th century, McKinley's tariffs, post-World War II arguments over tariffs, they were all about Congress imposing tariffs.
Right.
It seems now that one big change has been that Congress has delegated the power over international trade and imposing tariffs to the president.
Right.
And that complicates things, it seems to me, or it makes things easier for the president to impose a tariff, but it complicates things because we don't get to see the full arguments as they would be laid out in Congress over whether or not we should have a tariff or increase or decrease tariffs like we used to. What's the current state of Congress and its place in making tariffs?
Good. Now, I think the president is relying on some later statutory authority. But the history of this, I think, begins in 1934, when Congress gives FDR the power to retaliate against other countries' retaliatory tariffs up to 50%. And so the beginning of that delegationism of Article I powers to the presidency starts, I think, in 1934. And obviously, we haven't looked back. I think the idea that that means we don't see the debate behind it understates the problem. Well, first I'll say, to some degree, as you've noticed in these trade wars, tariff wars, the Chinese can instantly retaliate with tariffs. The European Union can instantly retaliate with tariffs. So I'm not going to advocate non-delegation doctrine here and say the president should not have the power in a world where there's executive power in all of these other countries to rip off the United States until our Congress can act, right? So everything depends on what other countries are empowered to do as well in these situations. But we don't get to see the debates that we got to see in the past. That's true. And sometimes it's just baffling. And perhaps if you're a defender of the president, there's a kind of strategic ambiguity. There's doing the unpredictable and letting the chips fall is part of the art of the deal, I suppose you would say. But we also don't get to have a debate about something that really is, as the founders intended, a power of our representatives. That's a problem. Some of the sort of Twitter accounts I follow and friends I have at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University suggest that the original tariff rates from Liberation Day or April 2nd seem very likely to have been generated on ChatGPT.
Wow.
Because if you have ChatGPT, the sort of AI large language model that, of course, our students would never use, but students at every other university are using and discrediting the value of anything but an Ashland degree, of course. And if you ask ChatGPT, how would you calculate these things? What would the rates be? You get something that looks suspiciously like those tariff rates, and you get the idea that we should calculate it via any kind of bilateral deficit. To many of us, this made no sense. Just because we have a trade deficit with any single trade deficit we have with one trading partner, there might be all sorts of reasons why we want to buy vanilla from Madagascar, but they can't afford to buy anything made in the United States shipped all the way over there. And so if we have a huge trade deficit with Madagascar, I wouldn't worry about it. So part of this is that the problem is so non-transparent that it might just be midnight decisions, fly by the seat of your pants, not particularly well thought through, and I'm not sure the way anyone would want this to go. And then there have been many changes since then that most of them, I think, are good corrections of that original policy. And maybe that's all strategic and the defenders of the president could say. The other problem is that you could think about what power this gives the president, right, to politicize trade. It's very tempting to blame America's economic woes on the Chinese devaluing their currency to make their goods cheaper, or different countries subsidizing their products and therefore taking jobs from American workers. So there's a certain politics of this that I don't always like, because even if I can recognize these rhetorical appeals have power, I'm not sure that they always lead to the best policies, even for the people that want those policies. And all of this within the caveat of, as a country that's largely post-industrial, as a country that may face 21st century great power wars, and we don't know what those look like and what kind of industrial base you will need. With the caveat of we're facing all sorts of prudential problems and we don't know what they look like. So maybe there is some sort of comprehensive trade policy or monetary policy that would put us in the best stead. And I'd be willing to hear those arguments. Those aren't the sort of things I see coming out of the executive branch. And as a result, I think, supporters of the president tend to support him more, and critics of the president tend to criticize him more. And we don't have really grist for the rest of us to sort of debate.
I think a lot of our listeners are thinking also about the connection now between tariffs and the volatility in the stock market. The market seems to go up and down depending over the last couple of months, depending on what is said about tariffs. And for our listeners, the economics of this, what's the connection between tariffs and volatility in the stock market?
Well, first of all, there's volatility in the tariff policy, right? So the volatility starts with these surprising and maybe sort of shocking decisions. And whenever you see surprising decisions, whether it's the Fed that makes a decision, a surprising decision on interest rates, or of course, some of these tariff decisions, you're going to see volatility. When you see something as high as a 145% tariff on Chinese goods, everyone knows that's a fairly major trading partner. It's time to look in your stock portfolio and see, are any of the companies I own stock in, do they buy components from China? The answer is yes, and to what degree and how much, more or less than their competitors. It's going to cause a huge ripple effect recalibration, and it's causing a ton of volatility in the stock market, and of course it does. The stock market itself is not an index of sort of American economic health. Wages are important too, so it's not just the profits of capital investment and retirement accounts and so on. We have to look at whether people are seeing real increases in their wages. Are increases of wages going up with the increase of the profits of stock? That's sort of important. Are all different areas of the United States benefiting? There seems to me, Jeff, to be almost a new sectionalism. We talked about the tariff of abominations and how the Southerners protested against those tariffs because of their sort of free trade ideas. I think a lot of this protectionism now comes from the Rust Belt of the Midwest, our part of the country, where there's a lot of resentment of crumbled cities and lack of investment. And maybe there's a lot of returns to people that are now retiring to Florida, or a lot of returns to people in New York and California, but you don't see those returns in the Midwest, and resentment's a very powerful thing. Doesn't necessarily mean that resentment always gets people what they want, but they express those resentments politically. So we see a kind of a new sectionalism as we see this sort of tariff issue become the number one issue, I think, for a lot of I don't even know if they're, you know, working class labor or people that feel like they're unemployed because labor is not stronger in this country. And so a sort of like underemployed post-industrial places in the kind of places that the good jobs seem to have left. Those on the Electoral College map are the ones that Trump has been trying to win. Those are a lot of those blue wall states. And I think there are political reasons both of us can understand, and anyone that watches those maps on election night, why it doesn't take that many people for this to be the number one issue to now see this policy. And that's what they voted for. And we can complain about it when we look at our 401ks. We can complain about it. But there was no secret during the campaign that this was what was going to happen. And it's this kind of this politics of resentment from these kind of states.
So this is probably an unfair question. And if you could answer this question, you'd probably get really, really rich in the market. But where do you think we'll land on tariffs going forward?
I think the president will continue to backpedal. I think the president is a true believer in tariffs. You can go back to interviews he's given since the 80s and the early 90s. I'm not sure that he is a clear and deep thinker about why tariffs are good for the United States and how they'll be good for the United States. He gives a lot of different reasons and doesn't always make distinctions between those reasons. It might be good for this reason, but bad for that reason. And I think that's part of his idea, part of his sort of businessman persona, where there are deals that are made and people win and lose from deals. And if we're losing, we must have been making bad deals. I'm not a businessman, so I don't see the world exactly that way. I see the world maybe more like an economist, that sometimes both parties to a deal lose and sometimes both parties to a deal win. Most voluntary exchanges, we do think most sides win, maybe not equally, but why would you make a voluntary exchange otherwise in the normal case? So we want more exchanges. We want free trade. We want economic freedom. for all those reasons. At least that's the way I tend to see things. I think he'll backpedal, however, even though these are some of his heartfelt convictions. And I do think he has the best interest of the country in mind, for what it's worth. But I think he'll backpedal because I think that even though the demographics that support these tariffs are a really important electoral constituency, I don't think they have a pressure group. I just simply don't think that these sort of mythical white working class voters from the Midwest that we all think about as so important to politics, even though they might not be, I just don't think that they're organized in any way that can continue to put pressure against the president. I think you've already seen the less protectionist members of Trump's circle. So, you know, Peter Navarro leaves Washington for 10 minutes and all of a sudden there's a 90-day pause on some of these tariffs and the rates are renegotiated. So I think other elements of that that kind of Trump coalition, inner circle of Trump advisors will prevail.
And then that means that you think we'll end up striking deals with other countries, trade deals, perhaps that end up not necessarily raising tariffs, but could end up bilaterally lowering tariffs.
Well, there's some part of me that can't understand how this would ever work, but there's also a part of me that says the deindustrialization of America might be a bad thing going forward. It might be a demoralizing thing for the American people that don't have meaningful jobs. It might be a bad thing for national security. Those are huge questions that, you know, would take a long time to debate. But if I thought that trade policy were the answer, I would certainly try to pursue it in conjunction with monetary policy to make it a real comprehensive trade policy. And if I thought that we had rising peer competitors, so if I thought this is a, you know, make no mistake about it, this is a trade war with China. If I thought that's what it was, I would go after China, just China, right? Or if I were trying to renegotiate deals with the rest of the world, I'd leverage American markets one at a time. I mean, imagine, I think the tariffs would have been much more effective. Warren Cass said something quite similar. I think the tariffs would be much more effective if Trump announced these tariffs on one or two countries at a time. And you just see if what the rest of the world does with that. And I think you could make much more sort of incremental gains. The idea that it was not well thought through, the tariff rates were originally considered only bilaterally, that I could enter these things into ChatGPT and find the same tariff rates for each country, and that it was announced all at once. I think even if I were a believer in the sort of trade policy as the way to go to reindustrialize and strengthen America, would go about it a different way.
Well, it's certainly going to be fascinating to see what happens in the coming months. And
I am the most, I benefit from this every day because it makes the students so interested in coming to class and discuss these
things. Yeah, who would have thought tariffs would revive itself as an important issue in American public life? It seemed like a thing.
And the only person in the world that likes the inflation and the stock market volatility, because at least my students come in energized, willing to learn these things that I think, as we'd agree, are so important for American citizens to think about and try to discuss in a way that just takes the temperature down and looks at these things in a, you know, in a historically informed and reasonable way.
Well, appreciate you helping us take a step toward that today, Rob. Thanks for being with us again on The American Idea.
All right. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.